Welcome to the Active Travel Academy podcast. I'm Professor Rachel Aldred, Director of the Active Travel Academy. After our 2023 podcast season, we're happy to be back with you in 2024. Again, many of our episodes will cover themes of social justice, intersectionality, equity and diversity. This episode, my colleague and Active Travel Academy Research Fellow, Dr. Harry Larrington Spencer, is conducting the interview. Our interviewee is Professor Amy Hamrai, who is a designer, researcher and disability justice organiser. Amy directs the Critical Design Lab at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, and specialises in writing about disability, accessibility and technology. Among other work, they are the author of Building Access, Universal Design and the Politics of Disability, published by University of Minnesota Press in 2017. At the Active Travel Academy, we'd come across Amy's work and were keen to share it with our audience. This episode focuses on accessibility and urban design. Amy talks about thinking more critically about accessibility, expanding our understanding of what accessible cities might look like, and going beyond individual needs and adaptations to consider broader power structures. All things that anyone interested in active travel should be interested in.
So I'm Harry Larrington Spencer. I'm a research fellow in the Active Travel Academy with an interest in sustainable transport and inclusive transport systems. I'm joined today by Amy Hamrai for the latest in our Active Travel Academy podcast series. Amy is Associate Professor of Medicine, Health and Society and American Studies at Vanderbilt University and is Director of the Critical Design Lab. Thank you very much for joining today. So to begin with, I would be really interested in kind of a broader focus on your background. So can you tell me a bit about how you became interested in disability and urban design?
Sure. So I have been doing research in the area of accessibility for about 15 years. And my first project was about universal design and architecture. And so I was really studying the question of how architects think about the user and the user's body and what the histories of that are and what some of the contemporary practices are. And as I was working on that project, I started to get a lot of questions about how my ideas were applying at the urban scale. And so in the project that I'm working on now on livable cities, which includes things like active transportation, walkable cities, etc., I'm addressing the question of how we kind of design for broader populations or masses of people, which is a little bit different than designing a building for also a mass of people, but a smaller number of people usually, and not quite so entangled with all of the systems of the city. In terms of my background, so I'm a historian and ethnographer, and I work in the field of critical disability studies, which is a field that emerged kind of alongside the disability rights movement and contains within it a lot of ideas about questioning what is normal, who do we consider to be a normal person or a normal body, and what are the consequences for society if we are organizing everything around a kind of mythic average normal person. So the work that we do in my field really responds to culture and society, in addition to looking at shifts in medicine and science and technology and things like that.
That's great. Thank you. You've discussed a bit about critical access studies and where it comes from and what it is, but can you kind of talk a little bit about what it means for disability justice?
Sure. So for a long time, from, you know, about the 1950s through the early 2000s, most of the work that was being done around accessibility was really focused on one thing, which was to convince designers, architects, urban planners, that they should even care about accessibility, that there are disabled people in the world and we should be making things accessible. And this is the kind of like 100 level of talking about access. In the last 10 or 15 years in particular, there's been kind of an additional layer of discourse of talking about access. And this is what I'm calling critical access studies. And it encompasses people in many fields and also practitioners who are really asking the question of, okay, if we agree that we want an accessible world, what do we mean by access? Who is it for? Who benefits? Who is excluded from our typical notions of who a disabled person is? And this opens up a whole field of study and also of practice where we're really trying to bring a sense of accountability and also a more multidimensional and intersectional analysis. And so the reason why this relates to disability justice is that disability justice is a concept that was brought forward by disabled people of color and queer disabled people. And it's also pushing past disability rights. So disability rights is where that kind of traditional access framework comes from, pushing past disability rights to say, how are some of the ableist assumptions that exist in the world outside of disability making their way into how we think about access? And how are we treating access like an individual problem rather than a collective responsibility? And so a lot of the work in critical access studies is aligning with disability justice in the sense of saying, do we only value people in our access design practices who appear to be quote unquote productive citizens, like people who are able to work, people who are able to be consumers in really normative ways, and who gets left out from that? And so we can kind of get more into it, but there are so many types of disabled people that are not included in the traditional disability rights framework. And both disability justice and critical access studies are bringing our attention to that.
Could you perhaps draw on that a bit more about the kind of diversity of disabled people and the inclusion within the movement?
So in my book, which is called Building Access, Universal Design and the Politics of Disability, I ask the question of how did we get here with the way that disability is defined? And I should say, and it may be obvious to your audience, that I'm from the United States. And so in the United States, the disability rights laws that we have, you know, there were several laws that led up to the Americans with Disabilities Act in 1990. And the way that the law defined disability was very narrow. And this was because of political compromises. There was a sense that if it really encompassed all disabled people, that it would be too onerous on businesses to have to accommodate all the different kinds of disabled people. And so the types of access that are typically allowed and that there are building standards for and things like that under the ADA are really focused on certain kinds of mobility disability, especially people who use wheeled mobility devices, wheelchairs, scooters, etc. And then to a much more limited extent, people who have sensory disabilities like deaf or blind people. Mm-hmm. And there's really nothing about neurodivergence or chemical sensitivity, environmental injury, like long COVID, you know, these things that are actually very emergent and large number of people in the population would benefit from having their rights guaranteed around different forms of access. They're not included. And part of that has to do with the political compromise thing I was saying before. And part of it is the sense that there is a much more standard knowledge base around something like wheelchairs, how much space do they take up? What kind of ramp should there be? What should the slope of the ramp be? There's, you know, 60 years of research about that. It's a lot harder to do standardized research on people who have conditions that are like not as apparent or within the same category, but pretty different from each other. So if we think about autistic people, there are like many different ways to be autistic. And so there isn't one standard form of access that we could put into the law that would, you know, ensure equal rights for everyone. And so the way that this ripples out is if we think of in the context of cities, where do we find disability? In many cities across the world, there's a housing crisis. There's not enough affordable housing and people are unhoused. And a lot of unhoused people have disabilities, or if they didn't have them before, they become mm-hmm. disabled. And there's hardly any conversation outside of disability justice circles about attending to the access needs and access rights of people who are unhoused and thinking about housing justice as a form of accessibility, because people who are unhoused have some of the least amount of power in our society. And so in many places, people just kind of basically treat unhoused people in dehumanizing ways. And so part of what I'm trying to do and other people are trying to do is to say, if we shift the framework a little bit, we can actually think about accessibility in a more expansive way and then make these connections. Why wouldn't people who are trying to think about, like, how do we make the perfect wheelchair accessible apartment, also think about how do we get people into the apartment and be able to access it and live there? Like, these things are actually very much common sense, but because of the way that power works in our society, we're not typically asking these kinds of questions.
Thank you. I could ask you questions about critical access studies all day, but I do want to focus in a bit on your CRIP mobility justice paper. I'll link your book, but I'll also link the paper either in the transcript or with the video, because the CRIP mobility justice paper is a paper that I think anyone involved in active travel need to be reading. So could you kind of expand a bit on how critical access studies and disability justice relate to active transportation, and also how you became interested in this as kind of a focus in your work?
Sure. Yeah. Maybe I'll start with the last part of it. So I have been working on a project on livable cities for the last 7 or 8 years. And I really started with the discourse of healthy cities. I was very interested in healthy cities because I had learned that public health researchers were looking to the built environment as a tool for promoting health. And I thought that was very interesting. And it intersected with all of these other things that I'm interested in, like how does the built environment shape how we think about who exists in society and what kinds of bodies exist or what kinds of bodies should exist. And so I'd really been focusing on like health at first through architecture, but then of course there's so much advocacy around active transportation. And I started to do ethnographic research with urban designers and walk bike advocates and all sorts of people kind of in that realm. And so spending time doing participant observation with people who work in nonprofit organizations and going to conferences and working on projects with people. And what I started to notice was that there was this kind of like unnecessary ableism in so much of the discourse around active transportation. It started often with a lot of language and claims being made about body size. So these sorts of claims that are like, there's an obesity epidemic and the only way to solve it is for everyone to ride their bike to work and things like that. And at the same time, just the notion that there is a kind of like carbon footprint that is produced by cars, which is true, and I agree with, that can somehow be alleviated by individual people like choosing to use a bicycle in different cities. I thought that was so interesting because it was really about making it an individual responsibility to address climate change and then kind of instituting it on a collective level by supporting it with infrastructure. And in the back of my mind, I kept thinking about like, okay, but what about all the oil tankers carrying all the fossil fuels across the world and all of these things that have a much higher impact on emissions? I was thinking about how there is such an assumption about what a body can do and what a body ought to be able to do. And as somebody who is disabled and has chronic illness that often results in a lot of fatigue, I like riding my bike in the park when I can. And I also would not want to have to do that or to primarily have to do that. And so I started to travel to different places that were kind of exemplary or had been cited as exemplary cities for biking infrastructure, replacing cars, and things like that, and really just kind of observing people and figuring out like what is actually happening on the ground in these places. And of course, when you go to those places, there are not a lot of disabled people in public spaces mm-hmm. because there isn't, like, sometimes there's a whole like de-emphasis of the sidewalk in favor of the bike lane, or there aren't places to rest. And it doesn't have to be that way. Like, there's a possible world in which all of these options coexist. And I think a lot of people would want that. But for reasons that probably have to do with funding and then also all of the discourse around active transportation, there have been a lot of exclusionary environments created. And so I've been trying to kind of grapple with that and to think about the conversations I've had with people who I think really get what I'm saying when I ask questions about this. Like, I think that they understand, and I'm referring to people who are bicycle advocates and stuff like that. Like, I think that they understand that there is something exclusionary about putting so much emphasis on activity as like a morally virtuous type of transportation, bodily activity. But at the same time, there isn't really a sense of what an alternative could be. And in some of the social media spaces that I have been in, you know, there are Facebook groups for people who are urbanists and things like mm-hmm. that. I've often seen people make fun of the idea that bicycling can be ableist. And what they often say, and you see this on blogs and things like that, I've cited some of these in my paper, is that they'll be like, oh, but here are some examples of disabled people who do ride bicycles. And they'll show pictures.
The gotcha pics.
Yeah, the gotcha pics. And it's, this is the thing that I think this is why we need critical disability studies, is that when you look at these pictures, the assumption being made is that disability is this category where everyone within it shares an experience. And so, you know, I saw a blog post that had pictures of someone with Down syndrome riding a bicycle. And I was like, okay, great. But also, we don't know anything about that person's like energy capacity. Mm-hmm. So maybe that person is extremely physically fit and has no problem with this, and it's like the best thing for them, or maybe not. The existence of that person as a cyclist does not negate that other people could be harmed by a type of infrastructure that doesn't support them. And so this is where, in my paper, I argue for shifting the framework away from talking about individual disabled people who are excluded and more towards thinking about ableism in cities. Because if we think about how does ableism manifest in cities, and we agree that there should be curb cuts and there should be accessible public transit and all these things, then we can actually plan in a totally different way and on a kind of more mass scale for the types of things that someone may need to support them if they're going to use active transportation or not. And so, you know, this is something that's still, I'm very much still working on, but is the focus of the current book that I'm writing.
Oh, it's fascinating. I can't wait to read it. It's something that I'm working on as well. And also Rachel within the Active Travel Academy is also thinking about disability. And another thing that I've been thinking about a bit, and I was wondering about your thoughts on it, is often cycling in particular is positioned as being freedom, as being about being independent. But actually, when we talk about disability justice, a really important tenet of this is about interdependence and recognizing and valuing that interdependence. So I was wondering about your thoughts in terms of interdependence within active transportation.
That's such a great question. There's an interesting thing about the concept of independence, which is very much related to how we think about rights, often in Western contexts. And in the same way that cycling is described as creating a sense of freedom and independence, so is the wheelchair. And in the history, there's a really interesting history of wheelchairs being developed in relation to bicycles, and often using the same technologies, like the same wheels, sometimes the same batteries for battery-assisted chairs and bikes. And then the story that is shared about the experience of using both of these types of wheeled mobility is that a person can go about their day, do whatever they want, have total freedom, not have to rely on other people or have to rely on external sources of energy and things like that. And so the idea of freedom and independence was very much part of that traditional disability rights framework, and often would be articulated in parallel to or even drawing on the types of things that people say about bicycling. You know, I have many friends and colleagues who use adaptive bikes, for example, and really like describe them as like similar to a wheelchair. And no one is saying that that is bad. I just want to clarify that. Mm-hmm. That is really important because the alternative to it is a kind of like paternalistic, like someone not being able to get around or do the things that they want to do. And the invention of wheelchairs and power wheelchairs really like changed the landscape for so many people in terms of being able to live independently. But what happens also, so this is like a yes and, what happens also when that value of independence gets so centralized when we talk about disability or about transportation is that we tend to think of society as a bunch of atomized individuals who are just going around making their own choices all the time. And it's a little like ironic, I think, given that so much of the justification for something like active transportation is that we're addressing a collective action problem, which is climate change, or that we're, you know, in the realm of accessibility, that we need accessibility to give disabled people on the whole more rights. And so in the disability justice framework, thinking about interdependence and collective access, what it does is it gives us a few additional tools. It doesn't replace that emphasis on independence entirely, but it does allow us to ask questions like, how does capitalism shape how we think about people as users? And if everybody's just an individual user with their individual gear, already so many people are at a disadvantage. And so I'm just going to describe what happens in the US, but in the US, getting mobility devices relies on access to health insurance, mm-hmm. which not everyone has. And they're very expensive. People who have private health insurance, like, you know, still end up paying so much money for these devices, even if they have better access. And people will be on a list for a long time. And, you know, it's like $100,000. And so there's already unequal access on this kind of individual level. But if we shift to thinking about collective access, there's so many things that we can do that are in addition to someone having a device that gives them mobility. It can be like infrastructural forms of access, like creating infrastructures that don't necessitate a lot of like extra work to get around or that are easy to navigate. Creating some of the examples that come from early disability justice lore are times when disabled people kind of got together their resources and created access for each other in a mutual aid way, rather than rely on institutions or the state, which can, you know, that can be kind of tricky. That's like a lot of work for disabled people to have to do. But it's like a demonstration of how a shift in values can also then do this thing where, it doesn't rely on each person to make their own way because there is a broader collective of people who are kind of looking out for everyone's interests and contributing what they have towards the greater goal of accessibility. And I think that there's a way to apply that to the design of cities, if we think about cities as collectivities and places where we want everyone to thrive, it can mean involving like multiple sectors of people and recognizing how all of the different parts are relating to each other. How is housing related to the right to the street and all of these things? And using that as the template for even how to think about accessibility beyond this kind of like individual approach.
That's brilliant. Thank you. And you've touched on it a bit, but I was thinking we could go into it a bit more in depth, but it's about the way that bodies are commonly framed in active transportation policy and interventions. I know in the paper you talk about race and also race, disability, but also kind of this anti-fat bias, which is really interesting as well. So it'd be great to hear more on that.
I think that any built environment profession often reflects some of the norms and assumptions that are held in the broader society. And there is a specific history of the idea of active transportation as emerging in relationship to ideas of health and what is a healthy body. Mm-hmm. And this is because in the 1980s, the healthy city was part of the World Health Organization's agenda. And there's a lot of research funding from the World Health Organization and then later from different national public health organizations or agencies. So in the United States, that would be the Centers for Disease Control, that said, okay, we're going to fund interventions where you show that biking to work is really good for eliminating this health problem. Mm-hmm. And on the surface, that seems totally neutral. And, you know, who doesn't want public health? But public health is also very value laden. And so some of the assumptions about health that were circulating at the time have since then, actual health practitioners have moved away from, but these assumptions have remained part of the discourse of the healthy city. And one of those is a kind of anti-fat bias, mm-hmm. or really overwhelming concern with obesity. So in the 1990s, when a lot of these projects were getting funded and a lot of the literature was being written, the 90s was the prime era of diet culture, and everyone was doing everything that they could to try to lose weight and doing like weird fad diets. And, all the models were very thin and things like that. And so this really shaped what came to be regarded as a kind of common sense around who should be in public space. And it was not that different from earlier times, you know, in the eugenics era when there would be laws in places like the US. We had these things called ugly laws that they prohibited people who looked atypical from being in public space. And so people who had visible disabilities or who had bodies that seemed like they were out of the norm could be criminalized or institutionalized for this. And so if we think about, you know, like this thing that seems like a very positive and neutral agenda of just like getting everybody to have more movement in their day, which is great. So many people don't have access to that. For some reason, very unnecessarily became like this like film formed over it that was a lot of language about preventing obesity. Related to that, then if we start to think about like who is in that population of bodies that are deemed to have like excessively high BMI, well, the history of the BMI or the body mass index also comes from eugenics. And it was about determining which bodies were most fit for war. But it was also used to produce all sorts of racial hierarchies and of course, disability hierarchies as well. And so even though it looks really neutral on the surface, and most people, when I talk about this, like sometimes people get really upset or it just like produces some like defensiveness because it's like, well, how could it be that we shouldn't all be trying to lose as much weight as possible or to be a certain kind of way? And it's like, well, first of all, there isn't a lot of evidence to support that activity alone is going to change people's body size in a permanent way. Like people can be all sorts of body sizes and still be very active and, you know, have other kinds of like positive health markers. But it also, we kind of forget that so much of our reality is shaped by the weird diet culture of the 90s. And we're still like inhabiting that world. And that so much of the literature that we read about these things was written kind of informed by that time. And so we can start to think about, you know, what do we know in our present day about all of the different kinds of bodies that can exist and what affects them and what doesn't. And I'm just always thinking about, you know, right now the COVID-19 pandemic is ongoing. It hasn't gone away. And there are so many more disabled and chronically ill people than there were 3 years ago.
Yeah.
People are developing, you know, chronic fatigue. People are having all sorts of like organ issues, young people developing dementia. And there, at the same time, that is not the public health issue that the people who are advocating for reconstructing the city in the name of public health are focusing on. They're still focusing on body size for the most part. And so I wonder what it would be like if we just kind of reassessed our sense of the baseline human body to recognize that in the next 10, 15, 20 years, the population on the whole is going to be very tired and also probably very ill. And in many places, people are not going to have adequate access to healthcare and health insurance, or they'll be treated like their conditions are not real. How do we design cities for that public health problem? And that's something that I would like to see people doing, because I think that if we could do that, actually would benefit everyone. Would make our cities inherently more livable and usable than trying to make them harder to use, which is sometimes what active transportation can be doing.
Yeah, that's a really fantastic reorientation, I think. So again, within the paper, you discuss how disability intersects with other systems of injustice. Can you discuss how this relates a bit to active transportation and which bodies we see and support to travel actively? And also, I think something that's often overlooked in terms of health is those inequalities in, I don't know if you've seen them, statistics of injuries whilst walking and cycling, and people of colour are more likely to be injured living in lower income areas. So discuss that a little bit.
Yeah. So I really love the mobility justice literature that exists, that both comes out of academia, kind of mobility studies, but then also the activist side, which is a lot of activists, urban planners, Black women urban planners who are leading the discourse on this. And the really kind of like overwhelming takeaway that I get from mobility justice, I think is so important, is that the idea of safety on the street is not a neutral idea that we can just produce equally for everyone. That when we talk about things like pedestrian safety, we have to consider that people, like communities of color, especially like Black, Latinx, Indigenous people on the street, are more likely to be targeted by police for things like jaywalking. People might be get like traffic citations for riding their bicycles in places that quote unquote not supposed to, like, yeah, on the sidewalk. And that's not just a matter of someone getting a citation or getting arrested. Sometimes that, or often it results in more like acute forms of violence, or someone might be shot by a police officer or something like that. And so that idea, I think, is one that I want us to just like hold at the forefront, is that the street itself, in the effort to create public safety, there may be actually less like unsafe or more precarious conditions created for people who are already very marginalized. Another thing that mobility justice people talk about a lot is gender. and you know, the experiences of women, but also of trans people on the street, and the forms of safety that are just not guaranteed as a baseline. Mm-hmm. And so where I want disability to enter into this conversation is for us to recognize that disabled people of color and disabled gender minorities are uniquely at risk of these sorts of things that I'm talking about. So the research in the United States shows that disabled people are one half of the unarmed civilians who are shot by the police. Yeah. So that's a really significant proportion of the total number of people who are affected by this. And disabled people of color, especially, are at high risk of this. Disabled people who are experiencing access barriers, like that is like the whole other issue that we were talking about earlier, like not being able to get around easily, not being able to navigate the streets and sidewalks and buses and transit systems. But then there's just like the very fact of like who you are on the street, making it, making you a target in some way. And that's something that I would like mobility justice people also to expand how they talk about, because what I've noticed in the literature that I've read, and I'm trying to kind of add an additional perspective to this, is that when we talk about disability in terms of mobility justice, it is so focused on the infrastructural aspects of access that the idea that, you know, the sort of cultural and social dimension of the experience of disability in public space, like we can understand how that intersects with these other forms of oppression. And then, you know, class is the other really obvious one. And I talked about unhoused people before, but, you know, working class disabled people, or people who don't have access to housing, or people who just like look like they don't have a lot of money in general being on the street, that's usually not whose mobility is being valued and planned for. But that may also be who most needs to be able to get around in terms of different like social and structural barriers. And so we can really just kind of like enrich our discussions of mobility access by considering disability as well.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Thank you. A question I really want to ask is, so you call the paper CRIP Mobility Justice, and I think for a lot of probably non-disabled people and a lot of non-academic people as well, the use of the word CRIP is quite surprising to them. For me, I absolutely love CRIP theory, but that won't be something necessarily that people know a lot about. So could you just kind of say a bit about what CRIP Mobility Justice means and what bringing CRIP into the conversation does?
Yeah. So the word CRIP is a reclamation of the word cripple. And in the 1960s, when cripple was one of the kind of dominant words for disability, and then later like handicap and like these sorts of words that we don't really use anymore, you know, it was a word that came from the medical profession and described primarily people with physical disabilities, but also some like cognitive disabilities that had physical manifestations and things like that. And disability activists took that word and they kind of like shot it back at the people who were medicalizing and pathologizing them. And they claimed it as a source of pride and also as of group belonging. And the sort of the emphasis of the word CRIP is that it's kind of asking the question, like, why would we want to be normal? Or like, what is normal? Why is there so much value associated with that? And there's even like a really famous social movement badge pin thing that says, why be normal? And it comes from the disability rights movement at that time. So in the 1990s and 2000s, when the field of disability studies was emerging, there is a strain of theory within that field that continues to exist called CRIP theory that was picking up on that reclamation and drawing parallels between the word Crip and the word queer. Queer is also a reclamation by LGBT people of a pejorative term that was previously used to dehumanize and now is kind of like the basis of not just a group identity, but a sense of being outside of the norm and finding like a positive association with that. And so the reason why I use this term in this case, as opposed to saying disability mobility justice, is that I'm trying to bring in that sensibility of why should we accept a standard or a norm for society. And to draw attention to how there might be some standards and norms that are even kind of unacknowledged within the realm of mobility justice as well. And that thinking about disability in this way, that's not just thinking about like, did we check off all the boxes, but really thinking about like, what is the challenge that disability brings to how we think about how to organize society? Like that question. And if we, you know, accept that there isn't a standard answer and we're willing to work with that complexity, that can give us a whole bunch of tools for urban planning and design that don't exist within the traditional framework. And so I want to invite people into that and to think about all of the possibilities and, you know, and it can be quite challenging. Like it challenges a lot of our very core assumptions, but that's part of what's great about disability is that disability challenges so much of what we think about the world. And so that's kind of where I'm trying to go with this.
Fantastic. Thank you. I remember when I read Alison Kafer's Feminist Queer Crip quite soon after I became disabled, and just the idea of kind of the elsewhen was just so powerful that that has just influenced my work so much and also changed my own kind of perception of myself. And it's that same kind of idea, isn't it? That disability is valuable and it brings to the conversation not these kind of normalized views of what disability is.
Yeah, exactly.
Another thing that really called to me in your paper is how disabled people are often positioned as diametric opposites kind of within the active transportation debates. The very pro groups use it to show that active transportation is great for disabled people. Other the very kind of anti-active travel groups will use it to say that it's very bad for disabled people. And actually, it's something that I'm often co-opted into through my Twitter account. Mm. And there's a call within your work to active travel advocates, I think, to recognize that it's not enough to be advocating for these kind of for inclusive active transportation, but you need to be involved in fighting these wider systemic oppressions. Can you expand a little bit on that?
Yeah, and thanks for summarizing that whole problem so succinctly, because I think that there is this sense that you're either with us or against us, and I think all the sides feel that. The thing that I'm thinking about just really practically is someone might say, okay, well, maybe not everybody can ride a bike, so what if we had adaptive bikes as part of our public bike shares or something like that? And that exists in some places, and I'm really glad it does. But it doesn't solve the problem, which is how are we thinking about the values and virtues that are attached to certain kinds of mobility over others. I think that we've devoted so much attention, and for good reasons, to why cars are excessively privileged on the road. Like, that is true. There's so much money and research and all these things that goes into automobile infrastructure. But it doesn't follow from that, you know, we should not also think about the broader systems that transportation is part of. And like that, like I feel like it's very narrow to just focus on like, okay, let's have a type of mobility that is accessible for each person. But even while doing that, we need to ask questions about, you know, like, why are we thinking about mobility in the ways that we are, and why are we attaching the values to it that we are? And so I would love it if people who are fighting for active transportation and want it to be more accessible are also just fighting for places for us to rest, or fighting for transit options that are integrated into systems where we don't have to be using our energy all the time, because our energy is finite, and for all of that to be able to coexist. And I've been to a lot of cities where it does coexist, like there are just good planning. And I've been to ones where it doesn't coexist. And it's really clear that that kind of human element of what is the experience of being on the road or being exposed to the elements isn't as much of a consideration as the emphasis on creating, you know, bike lanes and things like that. And so I know that it's possible to create things like comfort alongside active transportation. But the way to get there, I think, is to interrogate, like, why do we believe that it's normal or that it's desired to make everyone have to, like, work so hard to get places in the name of, like, saving fossil fuels? Like, I don't think it has to be that way. We don't have to emphasize the, like, oh, everyone should be burning 2,000 calories on the way to work every day. We could emphasize a lot of different options, including, you know, public transit that actually works and is accessible.
That's great. And a final question, and this is quite a selfish one because I'm working on fellowship or starting working on fellowship applications, is how can researchers contribute more meaningfully to ensuring mobility justice is embedded in their transport work, and specifically including active transportation?
Yeah, this is a great question. I think some of it could be about adopting different theoretical frameworks and challenging some of the assumptions that are in the field. Some of it on a really practical or methodological level could be just very intentionally expanding the range of disabilities that are represented in research, not stopping the research that is done on mobility disability, for example, because we need way more research about that too. But, you know, I would love to see research that's about, you know, what is the impact of cities with a lot of cycling infrastructure on people who have like extreme sensory sensitivities, or people who get sick from exposure to exhaust, and, you know, things like that. Because I think we would then have a fuller picture. Right now, a lot of what we're talking about is based on people's reports of their personal experiences. And I would love to have a kind of like critical mass of data about that so that we could really consider what are some of the places where access needs overlap and intersect, and we could have creative design solutions.
That's brilliant. Thank you very much. And thank you so much for joining the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So that was Amy Hamrai discussing their work on urban design, disability and accessibility. I hope you found it as fascinating as I did. If you want to learn more, check the Active Travel Academy blog for the show notes and links to Amy's work and other resources they mention. Do check out our 2023 episodes, which include Dr. Therese Kenner from University College Cork talking about her research on neurodiversity in cities, Dr. Matt C. Smith from Brighton University talking about their research on trans people's experiences of the local environment and services, and Ekwesi Osei of Possible on his research on Black men's experiences of cycling in London.